Just as the farmer must spend a long time carefully preparing the earth and properly sowing the seeds if he wants a good crop, so the aspirant must prepare the right conditions and develop the right qualities if he wants an authentic mystical experience. But it would be unfair to the quest to remain totally silent about its physical result. Medical science has begun, somewhat belatedly, to inquire into the psychosomatic origin of disease and is being forced to yield, somewhat reluctantly, to the conclusion that physical disease can have a psychological cause. Physical health is something that we can only partly control by obedience to the laws of physical hygiene. For the body's state is inseparably linked up with the mind's. Both interact and influence each other. Wrong thinking, ugly feeling or disordered passion may not at once but ultimately can find expression in fleshly ill health or untoward accident. Thoughts can benefit health or harm it, can help the body's functions or hinder them. A man who feels the force of a bereavement to the point of intolerable anguish, may eat food and yet not digest it, may remain unnourished, become weak and thin. The body is affected by mental agony like the water in a jar by the red-hot iron thrust into it, was pointed out at least 5,000 years ago by the sages of India's Mahabharata. There are those who would attribute Hamlet's melancholy to the disordered state of his liver, but they should also inquire whether the disordered state of his liver was not due to his melancholy. Wrong thinking may reproduce itself in diseased tissue. Emotional upset may be the hidden cause of physical sickness. Moral attitudes are not without practical values. Mental processes may have bodily results. The relation between thought or feeling and sickness or disease is a traceable any of the pairs cannot be separated. A man who holds a negative emotional mood, for a sufficient length of time will, sooner or later, find it reflected in a negative physical condition. If it is a mood of excessive criticism of others, it may cause him to secrete his bile excessively. The consequence will be the creation of a bilious condition. If this is prolonged long enough, his liver may be permanently disordered. And if hate is added to the criticism, forever filling his mind, then it is a direct operation of nature's law that poison shall eventually fill his blood. Other negative feelings like anger and bitterness, frustration and hatred, jealousy and greediness, if strong enough and sustained enough, can become translated in time into bodily sickness. The corruption of man's thoughts and feelings are a long slow process led in time to the corruption of his body and organs. In bringing defilement into the one, he brought disease into the other. In his earlier days, healing agencies were unknown because they were unnecessary. If it is possible for negative thoughts and emotions to disturb the functioning of the body, should it not be possible for positive ones to promote it? If the mind can unwittingly create illness, should it not be able consciously to create good health? Logic calls for an affirmative answer. Nevertheless, if it is a little known but much needed truth that many sicknesses can be traced to defects in character and errors in thinking, it is quite fantastic to assert that all sicknesses are so traceable. Physical hygiene has its own place and importance, its own laws and principles. Moments of illumination. One difference between mystical and religious worship is that in the former there is an effort to unite through meditation with the higher power, whereas in the latter there is an effort to commune through prayer with it. The separateness from it is therein acknowledged and maintained, whereas the mystic seeks to overcome that. Each kind of worship is necessary to, and has its own place in, the spiritual life. The conviction that there is another, a power different from and higher than his own possesses the religious devotee. The conviction that this other is identical with his innermost self, possesses the mystical meditator. Meditation leads in the end to a sense of great strength because the meditator approaches union with his higher self, some of whose strength thereupon begins to enter into him. Prayer, on the other hand, because of the sense of distance between the devotee and God, keeps him humble and weak. Indeed, prayer will fail to achieve its purpose if it is uttered by one who feels conscious of his strength and wisdom, his self-reliance and self-importance. If it is to have any effectiveness at all, it must be uttered in a feeling of contrition, weakness, dependence and humility. Religious devotion is a correct attitude for all human beings. As rays of the spiritual sun, they should adore their source, As the imperfect, they should love the perfect being. All meditations should be prefaced by intense devotion, fervent aspiration, loving worship and humble prayer. The emotions must get deeply involved in this quest. Self-developing thought is necessary, but self-humbling prayer is not less necessary. The chief value of any kind of religious worship is the extent to which it abruptly recalls the mind from preoccupation with worldly affairs to self-humbling recognition of its own relation to the divine source. Every man has the right to pray to his over self. When he bends himself mentally in its humble silent worship, he is obeying a sound instinct and claiming his own. Sometimes within the periods of relaxation, prayer or meditation, but sometimes outside them, the aspirant will experience moments, moods, hours or even days of great uplift, serene exaltation or ecstatic inspiration. These are really glimpses, either from near or from afar, either clear or ego-colored, of the over-self. Such moments with their rich feeling and deep understanding endure in memory and can never be forgotten. They give another dimension to his life. He will come to esteem these infrequent glimpses, these brief illuminations, as holding the best of all values in life for him. Linked with these glimpses is all that the more inspired workers in every art are trying to find and express. It is the pure spirit of beauty. It speaks to their intuition and through them to the intuition of mankind, whose higher development is thereby helped. The felicitous experience of the over-self may or may not come briefly, but it always comes abruptly. At one moment the student is his ordinary egoistic self, struggling with his restless thoughts and turbulent feelings. At the next, the ego suddenly subsides, and every faculty becomes quiescent. All he has to do is to be non-resistant to the divinity which is taking possession of him, to receive lovingly and not strive laboriously. The change catches him unawares because of its suddenness. It may be preceded by a curious happy premonition. It may also be precipitated, marked, or helped by an important external event, or series of such events. But whether or not this happens, he will be fully aware of a movement away from the habitual center of his feeling, thinking and doing into a new one upon a totally different and superior level. The oncoming of this experience will be marked by various other signs. The intellect becomes suspended, will, judgment, memory and reasoning slip gently into mild abeyance. A deep serenity unknown before takes possession of him, and an exquisite calm settles over him. In these moments of joyous beauty, the bitterest past is blotted out, and the ugliest history redeemed. With the mind deep held by the over-self in an atmosphere of exaltation, the harassments and burdens of life beat but faintly at the portals of attention. The troubles of a lifetime recede to nothingness, the fears of the future decline into triviality. The outlook on the world becomes enlarged, ennobled and illumined, and is no longer bounded wholly by commonplace interests. Some of the veils hiding truth are lifted for a time. The idea that he has a higher self, the conviction that he is fundamentally a soul, breaks in upon his little existence with great revelatory force, and he feels he is emerging into glorious light after a dreary journey through a long dark tunnel. For the over-self to give itself wholly and perpetually to a man, is a rare and wonderful event. Most often it gives itself only for a short time. The glimpse is a fleeting one because he is still too unprepared to remain abidingly in such a lofty order of being. The glowing experience is glorious and memorable, but he falls back from it because he is dazzled by its brightness. He cannot retain it precisely because he is unequipped for so doing. It is a common complaint that exalted experiences of the over-self's presence are not continuous, are indeed utterly beyond the aspirant's control. The over-self seems to leave him and the loss brings him back to his ordinary self. These phenomena are not subject to his will. He has no power of himself to repeat them. The heavenly visitations come he knows not how, and just as mysteriously they depart. He will never be able to observe precisely the mechanics of this movement. This indicates they are vouchsafed to him by the grace of the over-self, or by the grace of an illumined man. Because they are so exceptional, it is folly to demand their return, but wisdom to work for it. He who has once seen the goal, felt its sublimity, discerned its reality, enjoyed its beauty, and known its security, should draw from the experience the strength needed for the hard upward climb. He should regard the short glimpse afforded him in the glow of these, his best moments, as a working blueprint. He has to make himself over again according to the mental picture thus placed before him. The difference between the idea and the actuality should shame him constantly into renewed endeavor, should call him to more serious, more frequent and sterner efforts, and should arouse in him increased ardors of moral self-improvement. It has shown him his finest potentialities of virtue, now he has to realize them. All elements of personality must be adjusted to the ideal shown by the glimpse, as the whole personality itself has to be surrendered to it. A work lasting several years may be rooted in a flash lasting only a few minutes. The delight of this exalted moment and the fragrance of this heavenly visitation will linger in memory for years after it has itself vanished. The influence on afterlife and thought is as long and beneficent as it itself is short and beautiful. The experience will soon slip away, but the memory of its certitude will remain. This serves to intensify and enlarge his love and attraction for it, and to provide him with beautiful memories to support and sustain him in faithfulness to the quest in the fatiguing long-drawn years of struggle and darkness. To that diviner self thus glimpsed he must henceforth address all his prayers, through its remembrance he must seek succor, in its reliance he must perform all his endeavors, by its light he must move along the roads of life, and of its compassion he must plead for grace. It is often asked why it is that this inner self is so cunningly hidden, so utterly elusive, so completely withdrawn from human sight and search. Why have we been put at such pains to find it? The answer is that the greatest treasures are the most carefully guarded. But it is also that the over-self cannot wear clothes of egoistic thoughts and animalistic forms without falsifying its real character. It is we who must shed such limitations and thus attain the capacity to approach it. God has no intention of hiding forever from the children whose very existence is the result of God's own activity. Little by little, and as they learn to use their natural endowments while they grow, they will inevitably come closer to the over-self, God's deputy on earth to them. Nothing is withheld from them except what does not belong to the particular phase they are passing through. They will have to unfold all their faculties of feeling, thought and will, later of intuition, discipline and balance them under the intuition's rule. This done, the revelation will certainly be made and the over-self will then of its own accord bestow its light quite spontaneously, at first through glimpses but in the end fully and finally. The over-self is the soul of man, his connection with the absolute power. One part of him lives, suffers, and enjoys in time and space. Another part, mysterious, almost unknown, transcends it utterly and dwells serenely free from its mutations. Every man in the depths of his essential being is an emanation of the world mind. Therefore he is diviner than he knows, holier than he seems, and wiser than he thinks. His self-effort does not bring the transcendental consciousness into being, does not create it. Eternal and undying, it was always there in the deepest layer of his mind. What he does is to penetrate to it, and realize it. His finite ego is not so completely sundered from the infinite world mind that there is not even the most indirect relation between them. There exists this holy link of the over-self through which and in which the ego may enter the divine presence. It is the higher individuality, the permanent self in him. But the over-self's immortality, although ageless by our earthly standards, is still subject to the opening and closing of the cosmic cycle. It is still a part of the world mind's manifested cosmos, whose merger in mind marks its own merger too. It is impossible for human imagination to conceive the duration of a cosmic eon. So vast is it that it may be taken as a synonym for eternity. The over-self lives throughout such an eon and then, with the withdrawal of the world mind and its entire cosmos of all things and all beings, into utter latency, merges into the ultimate void. It will manifest again only after the dawn of a new cosmic day. When we experience mind through the senses we call it matter. When we experience it through imagination or thinking we call it idea. When we experience it as it is in its own pure being, we call it spirit, or better, over self. This is insight, this spontaneous realization that mind forever is, whether as void or world. After a beautiful intuition, an ecstatic mystical meditation, the mystic believes that he has had a visitation by the over-self. But it can never really visit him because it has never really departed from him. It is an ever-presence, always with him. That which changes, that which moves, is thinking. Whether he listens or not and whether he hears it or not, the over-self however perpetually and silently says, I am. There only, in the consciousness which is completely self-sufficing because completely real, is it possibly truly to pronounce the words, I am. For in all lesser states man may only say, I am this body or I am these thoughts or I am these emotions. This is why what the unillumined man calls I is really something else. And this is why he must learn the art of abstracting himself from the not-self, if he wants the peace of true fulfillment. What all this has to do with the critical state of present-day world affairs should be plain enough by now. The connection depends both upon the truth of man's nature and the purpose of his incarnation. The assemblage of men and women called society is no less subject to the necessity of shaping its life by that truth and that purpose than is any single individual. Socrates wept over the corruption and ignorance of Athens as Jesus wept over the corruption and ignorance of Jerusalem. Men pass their whole lives in error when they might pass them in truth. They do wrong when they might do good. The result is suffering when it might be peace. When all the chief decisions of their life are made in a condition of spiritual ignorance, what other results may be expected than unfortunate ones? It is a bitter memento and the consciousness of their error falls painfully upon Thema when they discover that the aims pursued have led them up a blind alley and that the ambitions nurtured have yielded only ashes for their hands. Materialism is inevitable as a temporary phase of man's endeavor to comprehend the facts of life. To those who wish to escape from the pressures and tyrannies of contemporary materialism, philosophy offers the most effective way and the safest road. It helps to understand the true relationship between the divine and the human. It will enable them to realize their spiritual potentialities. Every nation's most important problem is human ignorance of divine laws. That crime and sordidness and the remnants of animality expressed in brutality and violence exist in human life they may not deny but they need not dwell on them. The evil in human nature is a fact for all practical purposes, however relative and ideational it may be for metaphysical purposes. Although the sage on his mental pinnacle may see divine goodness everywhere, the sage in his physical relations with men may not overlook the dark elements of their ethical makeup. So philosophy's aspirants must judge how far it is right to flow with the currents of their time and at what point they are to resist them. If others behave wrongly, let them have the pleasure of behaving rightly. If others are foolish and selfish, let them have the satisfaction of being wise and altruistic. If humanity is going downhill, let them start going uphill. Finis.